Welcome to 2007 on Fusion View. We start this year finding out from the poet James Wood what it takes to make it as a poet and what advice he has for would-be wordsmiths.
Now, just to set the scene, can you tell us who you are and how poetry fits into your life?
Okay, well, I work at the moment in Edinburgh, having lived in London for around about 10 years. I moved up here 2 years ago. And I have a full-time job writing adverts and various other things, brochures, technical manuals for a company. I also am a book reviewer for Scotland on Sunday, the Scottish Review of Books, and most recently the Daily Telegraph. And poetry fits into my life whenever I can find time to get it to fit in or whenever inspiration strikes. Typically, I'm writing 3 or 4 times a week, if not more, and certainly always thinking about stuff.
So words are really a very an integral part of your life.
That's right. I mean, it's very much how I earn my living, whether I like it or not. When one earns one's living by the pen in many different ways, as a journalist, and obviously I do earn part of my living that way, and then also pretty much as a pen for hire for most of the time.
So writing adverts and that sort of thing, it's quite different from poetry, isn't it?
It is. It's curious because it's still playing with words. And I think as long as you remember that there's that kind of element of fun and play, I think there is. That's pretty much where the similarity ends. But, you know, for instance, I will write manuals about network systems design, or I've written about, you know, complex engineering concepts. I've written for the financial services industry. And it's very much just turning the pen to whatever it is the client needs doing, pretty much.
And so how did poetry come into your life in the first place? What drew you to poetry?
Yeah, well, I've always loved music and writing, and poetry struck me as the ideal combination of these two loves. And I think that, you know, although this is deeply unfashionable to say it, I think that language put into meter and rhyme has a certain kind of magic, and that as a poet there's a great deal of, or in writing poetry, I think calling oneself a poet is always a mistake, but in writing poetry effectively, if it's done well, it's like casting a spell. It's not for nothing that almost every human society has closely linked the ideas of ruling, religion, and poetry.
And so poetry is something to do with one's spirit, one's soul, and it's how you put it is that poetry is music in words.
Absolutely, I think that's right. I mean, I think there's a great deal of false debate going on at the moment, which has been going on ever since the 1960s, about is it a pop song or is it a poem. That is something that, for instance, John Dowland, who wrote the first and second books of Ayres in the Elizabethan period, or Robert Burns, would never have bothered themselves with. I mean, they simply wrote songs and poems, and the poems could be set to music or the songs could be read. It wasn't this kind of, you know, there wasn't a perceived hierarchy between the two.
And so when did you write your first poem?
No idea about that one. I mean, it may have been when I was 5. That's certainly when I wrote my first story, when I was 5 years old. And there's no question that I was writing bad impressions of Yeats, Dylan Thomas and Hardy by the time I was 16.
So poetry is in your blood, as it were.
Well, it's quite interesting because I think that's a very interesting point, because my grandmother was able to recite Scottish folk poetry, and my mother was very good at reciting poetry at school, and my grandfather loved doing crosswords. I think my father is absolutely aghast and has no idea where I get it all from, but there's certainly a love of language in the family. Yeah.
You're a published poet. How does one start? When did you have your poem first published?
I first had poetry published in a school magazine, and then I was quite widely published in magazines from universities at university, culminating in an appearance with 18 other writers in the very first Oxford and Cambridge Poetry Annual since 1927, which was published in 1992. And I also had my first book published by Cambridge University in my final year.
So you really had quite a lot of success in your teens and early 20s.
Yeah, well, it didn't feel like it at the time, but it doesn't. I guess looking back on it, that's the case, yeah.
And so you went to America and it was on a poetry scholarship?
That's correct, yes. I was I was lucky enough to have a place working with Derek Walcott, who won the Nobel Prize in 1992.
Gosh.
And also Geoffrey Hill, who's a very highly regarded writer, not least of which by myself. Robert Pinsky was my other tutor, who went on to become the U.S. Poet Laureate for many years.
And so how does one go about getting a poetry scholarship?
Well, it was suggested to me by my tutors at Cambridge because I'd done quite well in the creative writing paper of the TRIPOS, which is an optional paper you can sit at Cambridge. And obviously they'd seen the book and they'd seen my work in magazines. And so the creative writing fellow at Cambridge at the time, Joe Shapcott, suggested that I apply for one of these courses.
And when you got there, was it for a year?
It was for a year indeed.
Gosh, and what does one study? I mean, how do you go about sort of studying it and practicing it?
Well, there's the line from Yeats's Sailing to Byzantium about there being no singing school, but studying monuments of its own magnificence. And so I did combine academic study with Professor Hill, Geoffrey Hill, who absolutely is not keen on the whole creative writing program thing. With working through poems with Derek Walcott and Robert Pinsky. And so we would discuss, for instance, the opening of The Inferno by Dante, or we would discuss a piece by Hardy and look at how those poems worked. And oftentimes Walcott particularly would set, I think me particularly, some tests to go off and attempt in the weeks. So I would have a one-to-one tutorial with him, and he would say, go off and do this, and I would go off and do it to the best of my ability.
It's quite interesting, I guess, because I always think of poets as wandering lonely as a cloud, and suddenly, you know, creativity hits them, and they scribble something down. What you're describing is a much more rigorous intellectual approach.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are so many different aspects to writing poetry. One thing that's always quite attracted me is Larkin's image of the fork and the knife, that one needs the technical ability with language, which is the fork, together with the emotional intensity and depth, which is the knife. And really, one without the other isn't a great deal of use. You know, so I think I've spent years and years now, I mean, over 20 years, and it will never end, but trying to improve my craft. And then I think the image that you have is not altogether incorrect. You know, it's not as if I sit at my desk every day from 5:30 in the morning till 7, sadly. It's much more the case that, for instance, the other day, I woke up at 4:30 in the morning with an idea and had to run through to the other room and write it down.
And is that important, do you think, to capture the moment?
Absolutely, yes. Because it really does come, and I think it's back to talking about music, I will catch a note, and then that note will suggest other things, sonically and in terms of the ideas that develop through the piece. And so the piece will, I think increasingly now, as I get older and kind of less energetic or whatever it is, I'm not sure, but you know, it takes longer now, I find, for these things to come out. I would say on the whole, I find the results more satisfactory. I think when I was in my early 20s and didn't know much about anything and had nothing to say, I'd sit there quite merrily concocting terza rima about two cockroaches coupling on my wall or something.
And so let's just stick with the creation of a poem, because I find this quite interesting. So you wake up in the morning, you rush over, you write your notes, and you might come back a bit later and tinker with it. And at the end of this process, could it take a few days, a few years? And what is the poem like at the end compared to the notes that you've scribbled at the beginning?
Well, it's very interesting. So first of all, there's a few questions there. It can take years. There's a great quote from Mallarmé, from Villiers de l'Isle Adam, which is very close to my heart, which is that a poem is never finished, merely abandoned. Mm. You know, you give up on them. They're never perfect. And then the other interesting thing I think about that is that it can often be very, very different from the first notes. I mean, again, to talk about Yeats used to write a prose draft of all of his poems.
Gosh.
And then turn them into poems. And I think that's a very That's a very sensible approach, if you're supposed to have a sensible approach to poems. But the initial form that suggests itself to you is not always the one in which the poem finds itself by the end.
That's interesting. So, because I find writing poetry very difficult, because as a novelist, I go blah, 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 blah. You know, 400 pages later, I've got something. Mm. And to kind of reduce it down to, you know, to, I don't know, 50 words or whatever. And actually, that might encourage me to try writing a poem, perhaps later on tonight, to write something down in prose and then to craft it out of that hunk of prose.
That's right. Yes, it's a very interesting technique. I have to say, that's not exactly what I do, but it's certainly, if it worked for Yeats, then it's pretty much good enough for the rest of us.
Indeed. Now, your poems are I find them very relevant to the modern world, because they draw on the experience of going to the office. You talk about mortgages and all the sort of daily worries that kind of connect with us who are, you know, living in cities and having to get on the tube and go to work. How do you kind of draw all that together and is it poetry? Shouldn't you be writing about, you know, fields of flowers and things?
Well, I mean, in terms of how I draw it together, it's really just how things suggest themselves. So, for instance, I have written a poem which isn't in the book, although it will probably come be in my next book, called Down the Drain, which is about the tube between Waterloo and Bank Station. And as I was walking down the steps one day, I heard the word steps. I was walking down, I heard the word steps. And it suddenly occurred to me, all these people are sheep. And so I came up with the line, like abattoir sheep without the pre-death sex. They shuffle down the steps to meet their Bakerloo.
Okay. Oh, you're going to get me very depressed. It's going to work tomorrow morning.
Sorry, but you know, so that's how these things kind of occurred to me. And thereafter, as I say, the musicality and the different ideas that one wants to work in happened. It's a very, very powerful thing which Geoffrey Hill used to talk to me about, which is that any poet, and even the ones who are from the worst to the best, are effectively barometers responding to the atmospheric pressures around them. Okay, so if you put Gerard Manley Hopkins, for instance, in Ireland, as the Jesuit Society of Jesus did, his responses were markedly different to the Irish experience, to his response compared to when one compares them with his experiences of the English and Welsh landscapes in which he was put earlier in his career.
Mm-hmm.
So it really is just a question of, there is a sensitivity which responds to all that is around it, I think.
Mm. And so in a way, poems help us see the world around us, whatever that is, in a new way.
Well, that's the hope. I think if that doesn't happen in a poem, then one of the purposes of poetry, I think, I think the reader leaves the poem disappointed.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think are the purposes of poetry?
Well, I mean, there are so many, it's almost difficult to know where to begin. I mean, certainly offering a different perspective on an experience would be one of them. I think to create a kind of spell through the use of language, I alluded to that before, I think, mm. is another. To entertain, to make people laugh, to move them. All of these things are, I think, the purpose of poetry. We could then get into talking about poetry and painting. We could get into talking about poetry and memory. I don't know that we have all night, but you know, there's so many.
The poetry,
but
of everything.
Absolutely.
Which neatly brings us to, of course, your book, your anthology, The Theory of Everything.
Yep.
What are the themes within that collection?
Well, according to the people quoted on the back, it's all about the extraordinary found in everyday experience. And I think I'm quite comfortable with that. I say this because I didn't choose the title of the book. It was chosen by the publisher. And I think when the review copies were sent out to those three very estimable writers who were kind enough to say those lovely things about my book, I suddenly thought, yes, you know, that is what I'm trying to do. The thing is, the poems there, it's no surprise to anyone, I've been writing for over 20 years, those poems come from a much, much, much wider body of poetry. And really, those were the ones selected by the publishers and then commented on by the first readers of the book in the way that you can see on the back cover. So it's only through working with the publisher and my readers that I've come to understand what the themes are. But I think, yes, that idea that for all of us, wherever we are and whatever we're doing, there is that potential of otherness. Mm. In anything we're doing, whether be it walking along the tube, or you know, or one, as you say, for my replacement, longing to leave one's job, or what have you.
Mm. And so, when you write your poems, you're not thinking, oh yes, I must write this because it fits in with my themes. You're just writing it.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, again, you know, I think it's disastrous, and I think poetry, you know, from Keats down, right the way down to Winnie the Pooh, so many people have recognized that poetry is something that comes to somebody. It isn't something that you go and seek out. I think certainly you can create the conditions, as, for instance, Dylan Thomas would do working in the boathouse in Larne. But, you know, you can't. I think we've seen in the current Poet Laureate a disastrous example of what happens when you try to write poems and they don't come to you. I mean, his birthday rap for Prince William, or what it was possibly one of the worst things I've ever seen set to print.
I think it must be very difficult to be Poet Laureate, because you're paid, or you have this honorary role, and someone says, okay, write a poem now. That must be very difficult.
Well, I think so, and I think that's why so many people have turned the job down. Most recently, in 1984, Larkin turned it down. I think there were far more eminent figures than Andrew Motion, who could have taken the job. I think many people would crawl away in horror at the idea of being Poet Laureate, and I think even Ted Hughes probably had to take a bit of convincing.
Right, now we've got a question from one of our Fusion View readers and regulars. In fact, it's my cousin Pei, who's also a poet. When she heard that I was going to be interviewing you, she emailed me with this question to put to you. Do you have a moment when you're writing down an absolute truth about yourself, bare to the world, when you hesitate and wonder if you should do it? And do you see this as a vulnerability or a strength?
Okay, well, mercifully enough, we'll be able to answer that question in verse later on when I come to read a poem that is absolutely nakedly true from life.
Absolutely.
And in Thursday. I think more generally, it was an interesting question, because if you look at a poem like 88 Degrees, 20 Minutes North, I think that was definitely a case where I sublimated an experience into the metaphor of Arctic exploration. In slightly fewer polysyllabic words, what I mean by that is that I had just turned 30 at the time I wrote that poem, and was definitely feeling as if I had achieved nothing, which is something which is very common to anyone most people.
That's a milestone, you get a crisis.
Right. And so the first line of the poem, "In 30 years you got no further than faith," refers nominally to all of the polar explorers who didn't get very far in the early Victorian period, but could also be self-referential.
Hmm. And when you look over a poem and you see, gosh, I've exposed myself, do you carry on and send it out to be published, or do you go, oh my goodness, I've got to hide this?
Well, I think it really depends what it is. I think that, for instance, I felt that with Thursday, I felt that, as someone said to me recently, it's a fairly common emotion to bump into somebody that you once had very strong feelings for, and to want to recapture those very strong feelings, having just suddenly met that person by accident. And so I felt that it was legitimate, because it was my version of something that almost everybody would be able to relate to at some point.
Mm-hmm.
If, on the other hand, you know, the poems, which I mercifully have stopped writing them since the age of about 18, but anything that, for instance, deals with any personal difficulty I might be having, or, oh, I'm so sad because the world isn't fair, or any of that nonsense, which really doesn't deserve to turn up in print, then yes, I just throw them away. But mercifully, I think one develops a tighter and tighter filter as one gets older. Mm. And that's the kind of thing that I wouldn't really even consider writing about now.
Well, okay. We novelists are always talking about our advances and royalties, and we're dreaming of earning enough from writing to give up our day jobs. What is it like for poets?
Well, I think the idea of earning your living by being a poet is preposterous. It's like saying you want to be a maker of medieval tabards or something. I mean, the amount of money I make from my writing is so small that it means nothing to me. And that in itself is actually a liberating thing, because I'm not bound by writing for a market. And I think not writing all day, or sometimes not writing for days on end, helps to keep me fresh. There's a wonderful quote, I'm sorry to allude to so many writers, but it's from all the other writers that I draw my strength. As Pasternak says, you know, poetry is like eating pickled gherkins. It's wonderful, but it doesn't mean you want to do it all the time.
I like that very much. Now, you're donating the proceeds of The Theory of Everything to charity. Can you tell us why and which charity?
I'm donating both the advance I received and my reading fees for 2006 and 2007 to the Pancreatic Cancer Research Fund. And I'm doing this because my father was recently diagnosed with this disease. Mm. Pancreatic cancer is horrifically underfunded in terms of research funds available to study the disease. And so I want to provide as much help as I can to everyone who either currently has the disease or will get it in the future, so that we can improve both the diagnosis and treatment of what is a really dreadful illness.
Mm, it's a very, very good cause. And you're now in Edinburgh, and you're closer physically to your parents, because they live in Scotland as well.
That's right.
And has that been important for you during this difficult time in your family?
Inestimably so. I mean, I can't imagine what it would be like, and yes, to put it as, but yes, absolutely.
Mm. What advice would you give to would-be poets?
Okay, I've got three pieces of advice. Number one, I would advise that people find a job that has nothing to do with writing and that pays you enough to survive comfortably, and make sure that it has room to develop and grow, because you will almost certainly never live by your writing. The second piece of advice is to ignore pundits, professors, critics, and editors. In the last 18 years, more specifically in the last 14, I've literally been called everything from a genius to a complete waste of time. And for many years, before my book came out, I suffered under thinking that, you know, the only people that mattered in terms of poetry were editors, pundits, critics, and so on and so forth. And in the last 4 weeks since my book came out, I have regularly been moved to tears by the comments of people who have read the book, who I don't know, who I've never met before. For instance, one person who is disabled reads one of my poems every morning when they wake up.
Wow.
Because they find that it helps them. And obviously you can imagine, I can feel the tears coming now. I mean, just unbelievable, you know.
Mm.
So, you know, don't listen to what all these people are telling you.
Mm.
And finally, read and memorize poetry that has stood the test of time, and keep writing. Mimic things, find things that you love and write poetry like that. Absorb the influences that way.
Mm-hmm. I think that's those three things are just so important, and particularly I think the second one, because how easy it is to be deflated by what other people say, and they may say it with the best intentions, but actually you have to write from your soul, and you have to write about the things that move you, because there's no point writing for the critics, I think, if you don't have the passion for it.
Well, I agree. I mean, second-guessing anyone in this sphere is, I think, an utter disaster. I mean, you know, if you sit there and you think, well, I'd better not write that because, I mean, it leads me on to a completely different point about the academization, or to use some sort of typically or rather appropriately horrible Americanism, you know, trying to kind of trammel creativity into the university system is something I'm vehemently against, and I think that's one of the things I learned in Boston, you know, that, you know, you effectively tell, in giving people a position as a poet in residence or something, at some point they are circumscribed in what they can and can't write about.
Mm-hmm. Now, in Edinburgh, what's the literary and poetry scene like up there? And compare, if you have also been involved in the London scene, can you compare the two?
Well, I can only answer this with the words of Charlotte Bronte. You see, you're getting a tour around literature tonight. But when she said, as poetry is to prose, so Edinburgh is to London.
Ah,
I mean, Edinburgh is such a beautiful and inspiring place to live. It's no wonder that there are more writers per head of population here than there are anywhere else. I mean, having said that, you know, I sometimes despair at what I see as the insularity and lack of ambition of some of the other Scottish writers. I mean, somebody said to me the other day, I said, how's it going after your book? And he said, oh, I've had something published in, you know, some magazine in the Borders. And I thought, well, what about the LRB? What about the TLS? You know, why don't you want to take what you've got from where you are and you know, take it to the world, you know?
I mean, is that your ambition, to take poetry to the world?
Well, I think that my ambition has always been, I mean, realistically, poetry exists in the valley of its own saying, as Auden had it. You know, you can't expect everybody to be interested in it, and indeed I don't. But having said that, my aspiration is to be involved in a debate with as many people and at as high a level as I can manage.
And how has moving to Edinburgh changed your poetry, do you think?
I think I give everything in my life a lot more time, and I am much more ruminative. So I'm a bit like some sort of patient bovine animal now, I think. But I don't think I expect as much of myself. I mean, in some ways, you know, you go to Cambridge or you go to Oxford or you go to some high-flying university or whatever it is, and then you go down to London, and so you're on this kind of track where everything is, you know, it's all a pressure cooker, it's all a genius factory, it's all these people who tell you they're doing these wonderful things. And then you come to Edinburgh, and people don't so much talk about it. They either do it or they don't.
Mm.
You know, and so it's a very much more kind of relaxed environment, and I'm able to concentrate much more on what matters, which is putting poetry, which is putting words on the page.
Mm-hmm. And you were writing a novel a while back. How's that going?
Well, as with the poetry, I kind of entered into some discussions with a couple of agents, but I think the two with which I had a discussion couldn't really get what I was trying to do. So I've had another idea, and I'm going to try again a new novel next year. It's going to be darker, it's going to be harder, it's going to be faster, funnier, and hopefully, you know, a bit sort of more complex than the ones I wrote before, I think.
Well, I hope you'll keep in touch and tell me all about that as it progresses.
Okay.
Now, to bring our interview to a close, will you read us your poem Thursday?
I'd love to. A man walks out of a station to meet his friends, not expecting anything. He's not hungry or thirsty. The late summer sky is overcast, but that's okay. Cars move past, people are shopping, glasses on the tables and newspapers in their stands. How nice to see you. But it's not them. It's her, her from long ago, when he'd had half a mind to have a life so different from what he'd cursed, then inherited. And all the shapely body, no tittle gone astray, is what comes to mind as he tries and fails to force himself to look into her eyes, says all the wrong things too quickly, too slow in getting in there with that suggested coffee and quick chat about old times. Or what about dinner? Then, like a fairy from a child's playbook, she slips away and his friends appear. Laughter, forks, and glasses follow. They smile and talk about house prices and careers or where they're going on holiday. He looks for her to come back past the station, but she doesn't, so he sits and waits. Now he's been waiting for years.
Thank you, James.
James has kindly donated 3 copies of his book, The Theory of Everything, for the Fusion View prize draw, open to all Fusion View email subscribers. To find out how to win a copy, go to www.fusionview.co.uk and click on the link to The Theory of Everything. If you can't wait and want to buy a copy of The Theory of Everything, go to the website of James's publishers, www.happenstancepress.com. All profits go to the Pancreatic Cancer Research Fund. Thank you for listening to Fusion View. Have a happy new year.